Good morning and welcome to episode 3 of Classical Voice Canada, where we meet artists and discuss classical voice together. I'm your host, Kira Braun, and I'm so very glad you've joined us today. Today's guest is Canadian tenor Taras Alexander Camille, who joins us from Toronto. Hello, Taras, and welcome to Classical Voice Canada. Thank you for joining us here today. How have you been?
Hello, it's my pleasure. I've been well. These are challenging times and totally new and unprecedented, I guess is a pretty commonly used word nowadays, but it sure is new and unprecedented.
It sure is. And for singers in particular, that's a whole discussion on its own, isn't it? How everyone has had to adapt and try to figure out how to move forward and decide whether we even want to be doing this down the road. You know, I think a lot of people are investigating options. But on to happier things. I would love to get started with our interview. And I usually start these by asking, how did you know and when did you know that you wanted to be a soloist?
I kind of came to that conclusion by two paths. I started studying the piano when I was 6 years old, and it came easily to me. I come from a musical background, a musical family. My father was a high school band teacher. My mom taught elementary school music. My dad was a conductor of a Ukrainian male community choir. And so music was always playing in my house. And after years of study and doing conservatory exams, etc., I had the chance to perform in a high school musical. So I went to Humberside Collegiate Institute. They were, to some degree, renowned for their annual February high school musical production. And I sang in the chorus in grade 10, and it was a great way to meet community and get a load of what applause feels like. And in grade 12, I got one of the lead roles in Guys and Dolls. And, you know, that just furthered my appetite for the spotlight. And the same happened in grade 13, where I did play the romantic lead in Bells Are Ringing. And so I guess having not just that level of attention, but that level of integration in the production be dependent on, have that much influence over, you know, the important parts of the storyline, etc., that really gave me a sense very different from what I felt as an accompanist, because once I stopped playing piano lessons, I still felt a lot of satisfaction out of playing the piano. But, you know, my role as a pianist in high school was as an accompanist.
Okay.
And I personally had never really had any aspirations to be a concert pianist in competition or in comparison with some of the people that I knew who were also pianists at that age. I found that I definitely didn't have the drive to practice as much as was required. I never sensed that that was a way that I wanted to take music.
I see.
And so that was the first kind of indication to me that stagecraft was also something that I really aspired to. And then I went to York University to pursue music. I thought I would pursue film scoring because harmony and composition was something that I had dabbled in and was very interested in high school. But I was very narrow-minded, and I really just didn't bother to try and imagine or learn how one makes a career out of composition. And so I thought, why don't I jump tracks? I felt like I had a good set of cards to be a performer, to be a soloist. My favorite music was operatic. I remember watching the Three Tenors concert at the Roman Baths. And that, you know, the last four arias sung were like, that to me was both the pinnacle of romantic music, satisfying, powerful music, and macho singing.
Yeah.
So, you know, those two together was a very intoxicating idea. And I was scared of trying to be a composer, so I kind of picked a different path.
It's interesting how being scared of one thing kind of pushes us into another, and generally that's the thing that we're meant to do. So we stumble into it.
For sure. I guess maybe not everybody dreams from a young age of being a performer, a singer. I mean, I came to it, I didn't even know, like my father went to U of T opera school.
Oh.
And he didn't really share that part of his past with me, even though he had a good 40 Schirmer scores in his bookshelf and loads. He used to collect, you know, all of the classic LPs, Beverly Sills and, you know, Alfredo Kraus and UC Bierling and Cheryl Melnes. You know, he had such a collection, both on magnetic reel-to-reel tape that he used to record off the radio. This was a big passion of his that he'd never really shared with me. And so for me to have come to operatic singing, you know, without having been led there is unusual and fun.
So two questions for you. Was your father the same type of voice as you?
Yes.
Okay. That's really interesting, isn't it? That the genes are passed down that way.
Yeah, and I would say my brother, who's a couple years younger than me, but we're similar in a lot of ways and physically as well. I think he also has the same voice type.
That's incredible. And the second question that I thought of, going back to York University. So did you pursue classical singing at York after you stopped the composition?
I did, but I did a very circuitous degree in that, you know, just through some personal laziness, disappointment, and angst, I got dropped down to part-time academics in second year. I kind of came back to it in third year. I really pulled up my socks after I decided I wanted to take a more powerful thrust into singing in fourth year and fifth year. It wasn't a five-year degree. And I didn't even finish after year five. I didn't come back to York University until 2011 to finish my couple of credits and graduate at that time. So I did pursue, but only for 2 years did I pursue voice at York.
That sounds similar to where I've been going with it, you know, taking 4 years instead of three and all of that business. But it doesn't really matter, does it, how long it takes us to finally get there, as long as we get there, I think.
Yeah, that's what I needed. You know, I needed to temper and figure out some things in my life before I could really devote myself.
Yeah, that's very smart. So along with all of that, I know that you also have another career aside from your singing, and I'm interested in how, and not only that, you're a new dad. How do you juggle all of that and also being in the Canadian Opera Company chorus? What are all the demands that you face?
Well, it is juggling, but it definitely requires some very, very solid pillars so that I'm not always looking at where to put my feet next. Mm-hmm. So my wife is an extremely supportive partner for me. And so, you know, she was a subscriber at the COC when we met. So she definitely has an appreciation, not just for the arts, but opera in particular.
Yeah.
She's a very beautiful and strong and supportive person and personality. And so,
By the way.
I'm extraordinarily lucky to have found her, and that, you know, we love each other and support each other in our goals. I was already a member of the COC chorus, and so even as we courted her, we dated, etc., 6 months of the year, my evenings and weekends were devoted to the COC.
Wow.
And, you know, despite that, when I want to take on or when I want to participate in a musical project that takes away sort of from our non-COC time, you know, she's always fully behind me and encouraging me and pushing me. So the juggling doesn't happen just by myself. I have that extremely strong pillar to lean on. And when it comes to watching over Oscar, like, we decide which parts of our day are important to us, and we make sure that we give him and his care priority. And then we also make sure that anything else that needs to be scaled back in these times doesn't scale so far back that singing falls off the plate or making music falls off our plate.
That's wonderful.
And then I do work as an IT professional, and you know, I didn't know it at the time when I was studying in this field, but it can be a very flexible, and depending on one's skill level and one's employers, it can be a place that balances very well with an artistic career. So I've been really lucky to find that in my employers, who understand that it's not just a passion or a hobby, but an artistic professional commitment to perform. And so, you know, I make sure that when I take on projects, all the stakeholders understand what my limitations are when it comes to hours of operation, times that I can be contacted, amount of workload and bandwidth that I have at particular times of the year. Like, I put that out on the table at first so that everybody understands to what degree I can participate, depending on what my other artistic commitments are.
Hmm. And just to dig in a little deeper on that, what is your actual IT specialty?
I'm a call center consultant. And so, you know, I work for businesses that have either technical or product or client support businesses that are not maybe operating and delivering the kinds of service that they have promised and that they strive to achieve.
Nice.
So I look at numbers. I look at how to put people in the right place to be there for customers when they call. And that all boils down to mathematical puzzles. So I take numbers and I arrange them one way, I arrange them another way to help articulate where a company is not optimal in the way that they've set up their client support. And then I make up models that show them what the results would be if Frank or Chitra or whoever it may be worked from 9:30 to 5:30 instead of 8:30 to 4:30. Mm-hmm. I present models that project results like that.
So resource planning, key performance indicators, all of that.
Yeah.
Math can be attached to both of your jobs then. Music is math too.
It sure is. And you know, I've always, that's fun for me. Those kinds of puzzles are really fun for me. I would be doing those puzzles in some other way if I were not doing the IT work that I do today. I don't know. I'd be planning kitchens, or I don't know what it would be, but there's something that I need to express mathematically usually that's going on.
Yeah, that's really cool. I also love that your son has an operatic name.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorites. Good for you. How is he doing? How old is he now?
He's almost 2 years old. He was born on August the 10th, one day before my birthday.
Oh, yeah.
And he is, so I speak Ukrainian to him and my wife speaks English. And we throw in French vocabulary as well.
Huh.
He's very chatty. And so, and that came to him very early.
Does he sing?
He does sing along, although it should have been logical for me, should have been logically, but I put on Maria Callas in the car and I've never heard him sing louder. That and the Lakme duet, when they were on, he chimed right in. And so, you know, I asked my teacher, should I have made that conclusion sooner? He said, oh yeah, you know, I mean, he hears that in the same pitch as he hears his own voice.
Yes.
Right, versus hearing my bellowing.
So after all of your experience and the various roles you've sung, it sounds like you still have a teacher and you're still getting some training there. That's interesting. Is this someone you've been with for a long time?
Yes. His name is Dr. Michael Warren. He is a New Yorker. Well, I mean, he's been a New Yorker for ages now, but I think originally he's from Nebraska. And He has a number of students here in Toronto, and that's kind of how I got to know him. And I absolutely do continue. I have 2 half-hour lessons per week and have been for the better part of 3 years now. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, I was just not as stable in my lifestyle, and so I didn't take as many lessons, but we've been working together for a long time. We meet over Skype, which is very effective for us. And I wouldn't be able to sing like I sing today without him. Definitely, definitely not. He keeps me on, you know, what I believe is the healthiest, most optimal path for singing the things that I want to sing. And, you know, you don't get to be the best or exceptional at what you do without a coach.
No, or overnight.
You need that voice, or that voice and the strategy and the hearing that you can trust above all else, especially when, you know, we get sick, or, I mean, just the sonic properties of hearing your own voice inside your head is not always the most trustworthy. I need him, I trust him, and we have a great relationship.
What's the one lesson that you've taken away that is a reminder to you, kind of an anchor to your vocal delivery and performance?
What I see in the models that my teacher offers is a very natural singing expression. And that is often evident both in infants who make a heck of a lot of noise. You know, for a completely unschooled person, infants instinctively make an exceptional amount of noise. And they can do it for such a long time, right? I mean, there's a lesson in that. And, you know, the same can go for children. I really very frequently harken back to what feels like a natural instinct, what doesn't have constriction. Mm-hmm. That kind of sound making, that kind of singing is really what I believe gets people to be able to sing Cavalleria Rusticana and Pagliacci back to back.
Yeah.
Right? It gets people to be able to sing Tristan and Isolde and then Queen of the Night right after, like the rumors say about Birgit Nielsen, right? Or like, you know, humans can do that. And it's not because they have some incredibly superhuman once in a lifetime. They've just, I believe, developed the natural, instinctive way to use the human voice.
Yes. And aside from learning how to deliver a relaxed sound then, or feel relaxed in your voice, have you had any really exciting breakthroughs that you remember when you did find that?
Yeah, I think one particular lesson that really kind of blew my mind is, at one point I was really straining to sing a high B. And my teacher had me sing it in sort of I wouldn't call it a falsetto tone, but it had quite a bit of falsetto in it, and just really sing it easily in that manner. And he pointed out that my larynx had never been lower in singing that phrase.
Oh, nice.
And I had no idea the connection between vocal sort of position when you sing with a mixed voice that you do with your full voice. And so, you know, that really stopped me in my tracks, because it began to build a bridge for me between, so how do people sing more softly? How do people sing with a different color at the extremes of their ranges? And upon further experimentation with that, my singing really strengthened at the extremes, especially in my higher range, simply because I spent more time practicing with less constriction.
That's great to hear. that's something that I'm sure every singer struggles with, finding that relaxed sound and feeling and figuring out what it is actually, what it actually means to let your larynx down. it's a soprano thing too, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a degree in vocal pedagogy, and I couldn't draw it for you. I sometimes fall into the pitfall of thinking that easy singing should be no effort singing. Mm. And there's definitely a very precise, critical amount of effort that has to go into singing in all ranges.
Yes.
And so, as much as I like to dream about effortless floaty or effortless high notes, I mean, there is absolutely a very important, unmistakable amount of effort that needs to go into producing those tones. And that's why we're so blessed these days to have YouTube videos and recordings of some of the greatest models that do that. Because you can go and you can watch this singer and how they sing the nine high C's on stage. Yes. Or you can go and you can watch this person in a concert when they're obviously not having their best day, and you can see where you thought that they always had those beautiful B flats on the recordings, where they're actually working their butts off there to deliver the precise amount of energy you need for each of those tones.
Yeah. Who's your go-to? Who's the favorite tenor that you like to listen to?
I listen probably the most I listen to a lot of tenors, but I listen to them for different reasons. If I want a great model to whom I can sing along without probably overexerting myself, not necessary, I would listen to Beniamino Gigli, and I listen to Alfredo Kraus. I listen to Enrico Caruso. I listen to Larry Volpi. And those singers to me epitomize how to sing in that both optimal and best produced and really optimized way for the natural tenor voice. That's what I think. I mean, I love listening to Franco Corelli, and I love listening to Mario Del Monaco, and I love listening to younger Jose Carter. I mean, I love listening to the tenor voice. That's what originally, like I said before, at the beginning of the call, that's the sound that had me, that enchanted me.
Always a tenor then. You didn't kind of need to explore, am I a baritone or am I something else? Always a
no.
tenor.
Always. I was growing up, I listened to pop music, and I always sang the upper harmony. I always sang the top voice. I always sang along with Freddie Mercury and Boston and all the 80s high journey, right? Steve Perry, Sting, all the higher singing is what I gravitated towards. Even like Four Non Blondes, I would sing along with the lead singer of Four Non Blondes, and Bonnie Tyler and Air Supply. Always the higher range voices is what I sang along to. I've always been a tenor.
So you're a rocker that we didn't know about.
Yep. Totally.
Love it. Now, I've heard you sing Ricardo in Un Ballo in Mascara, and I see that you have recently performed the role of Pinkerton in a production of Madama Butterfly with the Windsor Symphony, stage directed by Aaron Armstrong, and with soprano Taya Kasahara in the title role. What do you recall the most fondly about that performance?
So I don't get a lot of opportunity to sing solo repertoire with a full orchestra. So that is thrilling and invigorating, and it feels a little bit, it always has a bit of dream come true feeling while I'm singing.
Oh, exciting.
So I take that away. There were two performances, which is also, that's a very gratifying way to perform. Often opening night goes by so it goes by in a blink, and it's hard to really just harken back on multiple points in the performance. And so to be able to perform that a second time was also gratifying. Performing with Taya is really lovely as well. I really appreciate them. And I wasn't feeling 100%. And with the help of my teacher, I feel like vocally, I really came through. It was a challenge for me to disregard the way that I thought I was sounding and deliver a very, very strong and otherwise unfettered performance.
That's wonderful to hear and very liberating, right? So you are truly collecting a repertoire of the great tenor roles. And you've sung not only Ricardo and Pinkerton, but also Cavaradossi, Don Jose, Alfredo. What's the most exciting role you've performed so far? And if you had a dream role, what would that be?
So for me, Tosca was musically my favorite out of those. I really have an appreciation for Un Ballo in Mascara simply because Ricardo is on for such long stretches and has so much music to sing. But my first essay in university on opera was Tosca, and I played that tape until it wouldn't play anymore while I was writing. And so to have been in a position to sing the music that I had so deeply ingrained in my mind was a truly memorable experience for me, and that is something that I would really relish taking on again today after 6, 7, 8 years of vocal development. My dream role is, I think, and has always been Calaf in Turandot. That is also something that I listen to constantly. I listened in particular to the Pavarotti Sutherland Caballé version on reel to reel in my parents' basement.
Wow.
But in that sense, the music was my favorite. The character was my favorite. You know, that character is somebody who is both headstrong, but also deeply romantic. And I, at that time and today, I characterize myself as that kind of character. And Nessun Dorma as well.
So Puccini is your go-to favorite composer, is that fair to say?
That is fair to say, absolutely. There are other arias and operas that I also very much appreciate, especially having had the chance to be in productions at the COC of such high caliber. But I can't lie and say that another composer really just takes me like Puccini does.
And in your COC chorus position, you have also stepped out in a few cameo roles, right? I've seen you recently. Tell us a little bit about those experiences.
I've been very fortunate that the COC leadership entrusts, even small roles to me. I respect their choice to partner with me and depend on me like that. You know, all kinds of productions have different demands of character roles, small roles, cover roles. It's a very, very lucky position to be in, to work for the COC, to have the opportunity to sing in all the productions that I've had. Mm-hmm. And so in taking fortune seriously, I try to come very professionally prepared. And sometimes that is rewarded with an opportunity to play a bigger role. That kind of opportunity has befallen me a number of times. And in sometimes that's just not seen because it's understudy work, but it is a joy to learn that music and to rehearse it with the coaches and to rehearse it in understudy rehearsals. And then from time to time have an opportunity to bring that into the production, into the real performance. I hope that more opportunities befall me that way. And I'm not shy about letting COC leadership know that I have an appetite to contribute like that.
You must always do that.
You gotta put your hand up.
Yes.
If that's what you want. Nobody. I spent a lot of my 20s waiting for invitations without letting anyone really know that I wanted to be invited.
That's great advice for a young singer then, isn't it? To not shrink away from the possibilities and hope that someone will pick you if they don't even know you have the hunger.
Yes, and you have to be prepared. And you have to know your music in advance. You have to be ready to be counted on. You have to be ready to deliver even if you're nervous or scared. You have to be ready to deliver even though all of your peers are listening.
Yes.
All that stuff. The entire orchestra who you've seen enter the building with you, who you nod to, everyone is going to know it's you, and you need to be ready for that. And
yeah.
That's part of it.
I'm so happy for you and so proud of you for that.
Thank you. I've been incrementally learning lessons, digesting. It's an important and gratifying process, and fearsome at times as well. It's all part of growth.
Yeah, but I bet that you have a ton of support from your colleagues in the chorus too. I kind of got the sense that you have that.
They are the best. Yep. They definitely, they are the best. And to be able to represent them and receive their support is a truly wonderful feeling. I'm very blessed.
So when you are, and we talked about all the juggling, but specifically to the COC role and sort of the schedule that is typical, what is your approach to having to be in rehearsal on one opera in one language and in performance in another opera in another language? You have to switch gears all the time.
Yeah, that's true. So there are different vocal demands depending on the opera. And, you know, I think COC strives to provide diverse programming. And so, you know, we'll be singing dramatic repertoire in one show, and then the next day we'll be singing lighter or more classical repertoire. That kind of vocal practice for me happens in chorus music rehearsals and prior to that. So the vocal preparation that I do in warm-up and in learning the music kind of sets the table so that once we put staging in place, my voice is already kind of prepared to deliver what the chorus master needs from me specifically. Mm-hmm. I lived in Germany for a year in my early 20s. I studied German for 2 years. That language comes very easily to me. So learning German text, singing in German is not a challenge for me. And I can say the same about French. When I first started in tech support, I did tech support in French for laptops and PCs. So singing in French for me is also, and learning French text is also not, it's not something that I find difficult.
Fantastic.
And so that left Italian. And so in my 30s, I started to learn Italian. I went to Italy on two separate occasions to do home study programs. So I probably in total spent about 4 weeks in class in both Milan and in Rome, just in order to make singing in Italian feel natural. Mm-hmm. There's a distinct difference to the soul one can put into music and the natural instinct that singing in Italian can provide. And so switching gears now is, I mean, it's just not going from one mountaintop to another mountaintop anymore. It's really just going from one sort of incline to another incline.
That's a great perspective to have. And wow, you really are multilingual. That's phenomenal that you've got all of that ability. But the Ukrainian, you were born into and are fluent with. You've done some work with the Ukrainian Art Song Project in the past. What did that entail?
What I really got out of that program is how far one can experiment and eventually take a dramatic performance. So one of my own personal challenges is, you know, body awareness and specifically how I should stand or what I should communicate with my body while I'm singing. I really got to break down barriers in that program. I was very, very strongly encouraged to explore and shatter barriers in that program. And I speak Ukrainian, and that doesn't mean that those songs were or melodies were known to me, but you know, I really it was easy for me to explore action and explore text because the words were my first language.
Yes.
Ukrainian in particular is grammatically more nuanced than Italian, English, French, or German. And so having that as my basis really, really supports accelerated learning of other languages. There are a lot of grammatic concepts that were second nature to me already. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of sounds in Slavic languages that exist in other, in French and German as well. So pronunciation was also something that Ukrainian really supported for me.
Did you run into any surprises though? Because oftentimes when we're fluent in a language and then we go from speaking to singing, we learn that maybe we're a little lazy or there are certain things we must do that are different when it's sung.
I think I'm guilty of that in any language, whether it's my first language or not. I can definitely say that I'm guilty there. So yeah, I probably, had I gotten feedback, I probably would have just lumped it into the same bucket as my diction is lazy in French and German as well.
Well, at least you're honest.
Got to know where your strengths are and where your flaws are.
Absolutely. So when you did that Ukrainian art song project, what pieces did you work on?
I worked on two pieces. One is based on a text by Taras Shevchenko. So Taras is a very quintessential Ukrainian name, and one of the most famous Ukrainians among Ukrainians is Taras Shevchenko, the Ukraine's national poet. Mm-hmm. And among his most famous works are songs about Dnipro River. And so I got to explore that particular song, which has text about the river itself and how stormy and dark and rough it is. Hmm. How fierce it is. And at the same time, I explored the metaphor of how that might be playing on in my mind. So really exploring what a turbulent mind looks like and sounds like. And then how do you act out a turbulent mind physically?
Yes. And that's exciting to bring to an art song as well. It's very different from operatic work, obviously, but you can bring just as much emotion and text to that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely value in taking, I personally have labored under sometimes preconceived notions about how dramatic one can get with an art song versus an opera. Mm-hmm. And often you have a director helping you explore, you know, those dramatic limits in an opera. In art song, maybe you don't have somebody who's there to say, yeah, take that further physically, or yeah, try singing that underneath the piano, where you really get to hear how loud and turbulent, like when you're going crazy or when you can't get a thought out of your mind, you can't hear anything else. Mm-hmm. You can't think anything else. Maybe you need to be maybe try singing that in a place where you actually can't hear yourself. Like those kinds of explorations were available in the Ukraine Art Song project.
That's exciting. Did your family come from the Ukraine in recent generations or a couple of generations ago?
No, those are my grandparents were both from the city of Lviv in Western Ukraine, and they eventually made it to Canada and the United States, in my dad's case, in the early 50s.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so, yeah, my mom was well settled in Toronto before her 10th birthday, and my dad was well settled in Detroit, Michigan before his 10th birthday too.
Oh, interesting. One from the U.S., one from Canada.
Yeah.
I guess so, because my family, I'm just curious, my family also came from the Ukraine, but were German Mennonites, but they came much earlier to Canada in the late 20s. So I think there was a mass exodus at that point. anyway, that's really interesting. I love that history. I love learning and hearing about it, and I'm always excited to speak to Ukrainian people.
There's a very bountiful Ukrainian culture in Toronto and Canada and the United States, but particularly that I grew up in and appreciate in Toronto. So they've also, the Ukrainian community knows me, knows of me. I spent my summers and Wednesday nights in with the Ukrainian youth organization, much like Boy Scouts. And so I can't say that Ukrainian music didn't influence my current individual either. I play the guitar because I wanted to sing along to Ukrainian campfire songs.
Fantastic. Do you think that the Ukrainian community is somewhere that you will want to and probably already have done a lot of giving back to that community with your gifts?
Definitely. So in the last 5 years, one of the ways that I've sort of branched out as an individual musician is by singing in assisted living centers, both English and Ukrainian. I really found that I have a penchant for sort of the golden age of music, Mario Lanza style crooning. I love playing and singing that music. And so to be able to bring those favorites to people who maybe haven't heard them sung live in their homes, it's very touching to hear generations who have various strengths and weaknesses in their faculties now sing along to songs that they haven't heard in generations, songs that remind them of falling in love for the first time. So I have been able to, thankfully, also do that for Ukrainian care homes in Toronto and in Oakville, and, you know, sing Ukrainian songs for them. And so that's one of the ways that I like to kind of give back to the Ukrainian community that supports me.
That's lovely. I think there's nothing more rewarding than seeing the look on a senior's face when you know that you're tapping into something that they remember from 50, 60 years ago. And it seems like that's the way to reach them. They have a better long-term memory sometimes than a short-term memory. So those old songs really hit home, and I know exactly what you mean. That's wonderful for you to do. Thank you for doing that. I'm curious, with the trajectory you've had so far, and you're still really young and, you know, you have lots ahead of you, what's next? What do you aspire to next?
I'm taking the pace of the current times right this minute. So I have a two-year-old who who can't hang out with his friends very much.
No.
And that's okay. That's what we have in our life today. And I'm very grateful for him and the extra time with my wife. I'm very grateful that, you know, that we live in a great city and that I get to make music under my own terms. Mm-hmm. So whether that means accompanying myself, recording myself, or learning a little bit about video splicing, or, you know, how to cherry pick the best parts out of an MP4. I mean, that's what the climate is delivering right now. And so yeah. I love practicing. I still get to do that. I have voice lessons and I can continue to develop my craft. I can continue to forge my voice so that when we come out of this particular period, when I put up my hand again, I believe a demand for my artistry will arrive and I'll be ready for it.
So you're just waiting for that karma to be delivered. I love it.
Yeah, and I mean, it doesn't mean that I'll just kind of sit back and wait, but I feel like vocally I'm developing a roster of roles that are in demand. And I think strategically that's the way that I want to position myself as well. As our opera community begins to come back online, a lot of favorites are going to be programmed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and not only, yeah, and so not only is it important to have the lead roles where capable on one's CV, the supporting roles need to be there as well. I mean, our community is going to continue to be looking at ways to economize our productions. And so being versatile is going to be extremely valuable in a singer, and it's going to tip the scales in a singer's favor. The more supporting roles, you know, being able in a tenor's repertoire, being able to sing Normanno and Arturo and Edgardo in a production of Lucia di Lammermoor is very versatile and necessary nowadays.
Yeah,
for the modern tenor.
That's a really good point. Taras, you're a pretty serious guy. I'm wondering if you've got a funny bone. whether you have a funny story to share with us or anything that's happened to you on stage that you might want to have a good laugh about.
So one thing that I don't do well a lot, which I've begun to do a little bit more in silly moments with my son, is laugh at myself. I do take myself too seriously. But most recently, I had an embarrassing moment in a production of La Boheme. This is at the COC, and I was singing Parpignol. And I came in late for my line. I mean, it's not a lot to sing, so I'm really expected to just nail it every time. I came in a little bit late, and the conductor stopped the rehearsal and said, "What do you actually need me to conduct you? Okay then, watch for me. I'll conduct you." And so we did that part again, and my time to sing came, and the conductor did not point to me. Okay. And so I did not sing. Me being the well-trained ensemble musician did not sing without the cue. And yet at that time, it was actually my job to sing it no matter what.
Yeah.
And the conductor stopped again in frustration. And so, yeah, that was quite embarrassing. And I have to laugh about it these days because it was one moment. I definitely learned from it. And you know what? My record is broken. I can't be perfect.
Awesome.
I'll never be able to look back on my life as an opera singer and say I was perfect every single time.
My husband says the same thing. You know, what do you mean? You expect me to be perfect always?
Yep. And now I have one of these stories. I have a story where a conductor called me out.
Very funny. Well,
yep.
I'm sure that you'll never forget that conductor, and they'll probably always remember you as well.
I sang with one of the singers from that ensemble, and he said, "Oh yeah, you're Parpignol. Oh, that conductor."
Thank you so much. Oh dear. Now, we're getting close to the end of our interview. So usually I ask our guest to explain what the recording is that you'd like to bring forward and why you chose it. So if you were to, I know this is kind of off the cuff, but could you tell us a little bit about the recording and why you love that piece, why you chose to bring it to us?
Sure. I'd like to offer from who knows Romeo and Juliet, "Ah, lève-toi, soleil." This is Romeo's love aria when he first sees Juliet. And the reason that I wanted to provide this is because I'm proud of this recording. It was a live performance from my last attended intensive sort of week-long masterclass with my teacher in New York City. I had really had a particular vocal breakthrough in this masterclass, and it really made singing this song feel very easy and very natural. I felt like I could just plain sing it, and yet no matter where the note was, it was just eminently easily singable for me. And so it makes me feel good that I have that recorded, that I achieved it, that I could sing it that way, that I can sing it like that today. You know, it wasn't a fluke, or it wasn't a once, it wasn't a great day. You know, it was just, that's the way that I sing now. And I love that I get to sing like that now. And it's gorgeous music.
And oh, so I can't wait to hear it then. Okay. Well, Taras, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you. You bared your soul and you shared a lot of insight with us and a few moments as well that we all shrink away from talking about, but I think that's important too. We're all human. And I just personally want to thank you not only for speaking with me today, but also for being one of the very first people to befriend me and to be kind to me when I was an extra in the Dialogue des Carmelites. That was a wonderful experience, and I'll never forget meeting you during that time. So thank you.
You're welcome, Kira. I've long admired your courage in this industry. I'm always looking out for what you're up to next, because you're relentless in trying things out and doing it for real, right? Not in a private room somewhere. You're always doing it for real, and I'm just in constant admiration of you. And the pleasure has been mine this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And please give my love to your beautiful little family.
I will do that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I hope to see you again soon.
Likewise.
Okay. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you. have been listening to operatic tenor Taras Camille singing Gounod's Ah, Lève-toi, Soleil from Romeo and Juliet. Thank you for listening to Classical Voice Canada.